allows someone to swim with both hands and feet bound together. There aren't many of us who will face the possibility of breaking out of an enemy prison, having to swim across the castle moat to escape, but there's a lesson here. Astonished, I watch a man with hands and feet tied swim across a pool with a motion that is a cross between a swimming frog and an undulating eel. He is able to swim on his front or on his back, head first or feet first, Atsuhiro writes. And my teacher surprised us by saying, "You believe you swim with arms and legs, but you're wrong. You can swim without them. Look at fish. Real swimming is using the whole body." In my mind, the salmon surfaces again. What elegant example of adaptation, tenacity, and stamina. We are not fish, but from them we continue to take inspiration. In this case, the fish reminds us that swimming can be something to engage your whole self. From the rigor of swimming competition comes a devotion to swimming as holistic self-betterment. The emphasis moves from body alone to body and mind together. Think of a stream flowing into a river flowing into the sea. These waters run together in a way that helps me to understand why I swim. Flow. Water is H2O. Hydrogen, 2 parts. Oxygen, 1. But there is also a third thing that makes it water, and nobody knows what it is. D.H. Lawrence, The Third Thing. It's in the opening pages of Moby Dick. "Yes, as everyone knows," Ishmael declares, "meditation and water are wedded forever." Here, at the novel's beginning, Ishmael calls our attention to the crowds of dreamy water gazers gathered along the shores of Manhattan on a Sabbath afternoon. See all those people leaning over ever so far. They prove him right. The ocean's liquid fingers have a way of transfixing us in thought. Ishmael points out that the ancient Persians call the sea holy, that the Greeks give it a powerful deity of its very own. A maiden voyage sings with a kind of mystical vibration. But what exactly is the magic of water, and what does it do to us? It's a mystery. When we peer into a lake, river, or ocean, we find that water encourages a particular kind of reverie. Perhaps its depths can enhance our consciousness even more if, instead of just looking, we get in and swim. We jump into that water and find ourselves in a curious liminal space. Here we are, suspended, yet moving, floating, yet ever in danger of sinking. And if we swim with the current instead of fighting against it, we find a momentary state, one of motion and yet paradoxical stillness, that is flow. Flow is what the groundbreaking Hungarian psychologist Mihai Csikszentmihalyi explains as the state in which people are so involved in an activity that nothing else seems to matter. The experience of said activity, swimming, say, or playing music, is so entirely enjoyable, he says, that people will do it even at great cost for the sheer sake of doing it. I think of frigid waters, crack of dawn workouts, shoulder injuries, all the money I've spent on bikinis. Nearly 3 decades ago, Csikszentmihalyi was the first to use the word flow to describe the experience of being so totally immersed that the self seems to fall away, along with any awareness of the passage of time. Every action, movement, and thought follows inevitably from the previous one, like playing jazz, he writes. This kind of effortless, deeply engaged concentration is joyful. For me, actually getting into water to chase that ecstatic state of mind has a double appeal. It's 2 kinds of immersion experienced at once. In 1810, a century and a half before Csikszentmihalyi defined flow as such, the poet Lord Byron swam the Hellespont, the treacherous 4-mile strait that is today known as the Dardanelles in northern Turkey. He crossed from the Aegean to the Sea of Marmara, swimming with the tide from Europe to Asia. In the process, he kicked off a centuries-long fascination with the waters there. To this day, swimmers are enamored with the traverse of these symbolic seas. But what I'm most interested in is the idea that the swim is the thing that unclogged Byron's creative faucet. Byron was obsessed with swimming. He suffered from a leg deformity, which severely contracted his gait. He never felt so free and himself as when he was in the water. "I delight in the sea," he wrote, "and come out with a buoyancy of spirits I never feel on any other occasion." He entertained the thought of having been a merman in a previous life. He swam wherever he could, bridge to bridge on the Thames River, in a Tagus River estuary in Lisbon, down the length of Venice's Grand Canal. At the time of his Hellespont swim, he had published some poetry but had not yet established himself as one of the great romantic poets. His successful Hellespont crossing, though, got his muse talking, and he produced Written After Swimming from Sestos to Abydos, a satiric poem in homage to the swim and to the Greek myth of Hero and Leander. Leander, a young man from Abydos, falls in love with Hero, a priestess of Aphrodite who lives in a tower in Sestos. Every night, Leander swims the 4 miles of the Hellespont to visit Hero, guided by her lamp. One night, the lamp blows out, and he drowns, overcome by the waves and currents. She throws herself from her tower to join him in death. Of the strenuous swim, Byron wrote airily of the divergence and consequence for the lovers and himself. "'Twere hard to say who fared the best, sad mortals, thus the gods still plague you. He lost his labor, I my jest, for he was drowned, and I've the ague." Yes, Byron escaped with a bout of fever and chills, but for all his jaunty tone, he felt that swimming coaxed him out of melancholy, opened up his creative stores, and gave him access to his best self. In truth, the Hellespont became a touchstone for him. In 1819, he would write the first 2 cantos of Don Juan, his poetic masterpiece. In it, he makes more proud references to that crossing. He also wrote many imaginative letters to friends riffing on the Hero and Leander myth as it related to his swim. Eventually, Byron joined Greece's war of independence against the Ottoman Empire, for which he would become a Greek national hero. In time, Byronic would be a label for our most passionate seekers, swimmers, and artists. Byron came to represent what the cultural historian Jacques Barzun once described as a concentrated mind, as well as high spirits, wit, daylight, good sense, and a passion for truth. In short, a unique discharge of intellectual vitality. Swimming the Hellespont was the thing that loosed Byron's imagination. Only after did his words, and his world, generate a vivid electricity potent enough to reach the rest of us. 15. A religious exercise. The focused immediacy of swimming encourages a mindset that reminds me of how my young children think. It's an ever-presentness. Every past moment is immediately replaced by a new one, a constant stream of now, and now, and now, that doesn't allow much room to dwell too long on things past or what's to come. Living in the now is a state of being that my busy brain finds challenging, but I desire it. Swimming is an antidote for the existential anxiety from which I suffer. In Waterlog, his celebrated chronicle of swimming through Britain's waterways, the naturalist Roger Deakin described swimming as having a transformative Alice in Wonderland quality. It was an activity that had power over his perception of self and of time. "When you enter the water, something like metamorphosis happens," he wrote. "Leaving behind the land, you go through the looking-glass surface and enter a new world. You see and experience things when you're swimming in a way that is completely different from any other. Your sense of the present," he added, "is overwhelming." Athletes often talk about being in the zone, where performance seems to happen at an automatic level. Researchers have described this as a psychological alteration of time that pulls your focus to the here and now. You're so consumed by the activity and so occupied with reading and reacting to external stimuli that time seems to slow down, so that the present moment is expanded. The psychologist, Robert Nettifer, who first helped establish sports psychology as a discipline in the 1980s, has defined zone and flow as two similar but distinct immersive states, using zone to refer to the optimal state of physical performance and flow to refer to the optimal state of mental performance. People who are in the zone, he argues, experience time as slowed down. People who are in a flow state, by contrast, lose awareness of time so that it seems to fly by. For the athlete, of course, attention to physical performance is all-consuming. In a race, the point is to go fast, so the brain can't wander too far from that objective. This is the type of Navy SEAL laser focus that Ledecky and Phelps excel at. Even for me, a mere mortal in the pool, competition fastens my attention so tightly to the action that it creates a kind of tunnel vision. The neuropsychologist, David Eagleman, has determined that the slowing of time perception comes from memories being formed more richly during high-adrenaline, high-stress events, whether it's a competition or a near-death experience. Racing, after all, is the sublimation of our survival instincts into a competition. In retrospect, we remember those events in greater detail, so that time seems expanded, and thereby slowed down. Absent a race situation, or one in which water is a threat, though, I found that the refinement of movement to automation is actually the thing that allows my attention to shift elsewhere. While competition itself is at odds with flow, the training part enables it. When you've reached fluency, that physical ease and pleasure grants your mind entry to uncharted territory. Push through the looking glass, and you'll discover a different way of being. This heightened attentiveness, the ballooning of time, or the speeding up of it, the perception that time no longer matters, or that it matters less than you might have thought, is the kind of flow I'm after. As human swimmers, we can never really be the fish. You and I, we know that. We don't have to remind ourselves that it's water around us. But we get glimpses of what it's like to be the fish. We get flashes of forgetting the water. In the forgetting, we can drift. Daydreaming is critical to problem solving and creativity. Scientists now know that when our minds are wandering without any particular external focus, the brain's default mode network is active. It's what makes fresh, unexpected connections possible. And it's the reason you get some of your best ideas in the shower. The marine biologist and author Wallace J. Nichols is an evangelist of achieving what he calls blue mind, which emphasizes the importance of drifting to discovery and water as a way to enable that process. Being around water provides a sensory-rich environment with enough soft fascination to let our focused attention rest and the default mode network to kick in, he writes. It's no coincidence that Archimedes was in the bathtub when he deduced a method for measuring the volume of an object with an irregular shape. Eureka! In its power to produce an altered state, Lynn Cox explains to me, swimming is like a drug. Sometimes we zero in on something with unparalleled lucidity, and we gain the ability to tune out the extraneous stuff. Other times, the focus is fuzzy, and one thought leads to another without interruption. Who needs psychedelics, she says with a laugh, when you can just go for a swim in the ocean? The late neurologist and writer Oliver Sacks describes a transcendent state that is accessible to all from his father, with his great whale-like bulk, who swam daily and elegantly until 94 years of age, to the very young. Sacks wrote books in his head while swimming. Cox became great friends with Sacks, and on the occasions that they ended up in New York or California at the same time, they would go for swims together. During their first meeting, they shared a lane in a Manhattan pool. Afterward, Sacks climbed out of the pool, still dripping, to write notes on a waterproof tablet. Cox noticed. She told him that she, too, came up with her best brainstorms while swimming. They agreed that swimming was an ideal time to ruminate, to noodle for noodling's sake, to compose in one's head. What is it like inside Cox's head when she's swimming? It's a state between a dream state and an awake state, she tells me. Maybe, she says, we can call it sea dreaming. The rhythm of swimming lulls your body, which, well trained, seems to keep moving on its own, and your brain is allowed to go wherever it wants. Maybe you smell the coffee someone is drinking on the pier, Cox says. There's this awareness of the ripples of the water, the pelicans sliding right by. Maybe your heart stops as you see a wave of silvery anchovy swimming below you. In the hushed oceanic roar, you can choose to filter some things out and to focus on others. Cognitive scientists have shown that water sounds, the rhythmic hum of the ocean, the rush of a waterfall, are calming to the human brain. We experience a drop in heart rate and blood pressure and an increase in alpha wave activity. Those brain wavelengths associated with relaxation and boosted serotonin, as well as that creative thinking. While tooling around on Spotify one day, I find that white noise water sounds are some of the biggest hits on the music streaming service. One such track, called Rolling Ocean Waves, has been played nearly 15 million times. Walks in the woods are all well and good, as Thoreau illustrated in his transcendentalist classic, Walden. But during the 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days that he spent living in that cabin at Walden Pond, between 1845 and 1847, he also got up early every morning to swim. He described it as a religious exercise, and one of the best things which I did. Each of his swims stimulated body and mind. Each day's routine of rousing early to do so was a way to enact his desire to live deliberately in the New England forest. Much has been made of the walk as the instrument for big thinkers. Charles Darwin, Albert Einstein, Amos Tversky, and Daniel Kahneman, who famously rambled together and revolutionized the science of decision-making. Less has been explicitly made of swimming, a similar kind of aid, more medium than tool, for channeling the inner life and improving the flow of thoughts. Though Einstein could not swim, he loved to journey by water. In his travel diaries dating from 1922 to 1923, but just recently published, he wrote, "How conducive to thinking and working the sea voyage is. A paradisaical state without correspondence, visits, meetings, and other inventions of the devil." The physical action matters just as much as the environment does. The way we move our bodies further changes the nature of our thoughts and vice versa, notes the science journalist Ferris Jabbar in an essay called Why Walking Helps Us Think. It follows that pace of swimming, because of its fluid continuity, encourages a specific kind of thinking. There are the same changes to our body chemistry in swimming as there are in land exercise: faster heartbeat, increased circulation, more blood and oxygen to muscles and brain. Jabbar invokes the peripatetics of Clarissa Dalloway, Virginia Woolf's classic musing, ambulatory character, as someone who does not merely perceive the city around her, rather, she dips in and out of her past. Woolf herself, writing in her diary about the stimulating energy of walking through London, used energetic aquatic language to describe the immersive experience as being on the highest crest of the biggest wave, right in the center and swim of things. In his detailing of Stanford University research experiments on the relationship between walking and creativity, Jabbar writes that walking set the mind adrift on a frothing sea of thought. For Jabbar, Woolf, and others, the choice of words betrays them. They talk of ideas bubbling up, the tumbling of them, the wrinkling water in a current of thought. Walking is conducive to thinking, but swimming is just as true a conduit. To live deliberately as a swimmer means that you are a seeker, a chaser of the ocean's blue corduroy, a follower of river veins. The science writer Florence Williams notes that place matters, something that poets and philosophers from Aristotle to Wordsworth have been telling us for ages. Our nervous systems are built to resonate with set points in the environment, Williams writes, in her book The Nature Fix. Science is now bearing out what the Romantics knew to be true. Byron knew it, and swam after it whenever he could. We want to be near the ocean, the lake, the river. We build houses on the beach despite hurricane warnings and sea level rise because that view does something to us. Hospital patients recovering from heart surgery have been found to need less pain medication when there are nature scenes at the foot of their beds. An image that includes water is even more effective than an image of an enclosed forest in reducing anxiety during the postoperative period. As humans, we need doses of nature, and because our brains especially love water, Williams writes, we need more blue space, not just green space, in our urban areas. Williams gives a shout-out to the aquatic specialness of the San Francisco Bay Area, all those South End and Dolphin Club swimmers stroking to Alcatraz, but reserves her greatest admiration for Wellington, New Zealand, which has a public snorkel trail. Book your tickets now. During one of their swims, Cox asked Sachs if she could give him a tip or two on his backstroke. He was happy and agreeable about it, because anything that allowed him to swim more easily meant that he could swim without having to devote too much mental bandwidth to the act, freeing his mind to puzzle over other things. In 2015, Sachs was 82 and dying of cancer, and yet he still swam a mile a day for as long as he could, writing until the end. Joy is quite simply essential to the achievement of the flow state. Both Nedifer and Csikszentmihalyi emphasize that the psychological challenge has to be something we love doing, or we can't get there. As much as I try to stick with scientists and studies in the examination of flow, I can't help but turn back to the poets for the most convincing evidence of swimming's perks. Swimming can lead to creative output and discovery, certainly. But it is also a way to change your mood, because when you get down to it, flow is nothing if it's not getting lost in the sensory pleasure of the thing. A rural New Hampshire farm was home to Maxine Cumin, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet who died in 2014. She was also a swimmer, lucky for us. Her particular swimming history included stints as an instructor at a summer camp and captain of the swim team at Radcliffe College. In an early poem titled Junior Lifesaving, she summoned up the wild angles and textures of kids by a lake in summer, from the isosceles of knees to their sun-killed skin. The lake itself is sentient, witty. It has timing. It smiles to a fish and quiets back to glass. Swimming to the children is magic. She hates to tell them of the perils of that water, hates to watch the magic seep away. But she does it still. It's her job. She teaches them the skills they need to keep themselves, and that magic, alive. Later in life, Cumin wrote of solitary daily swims in what she called her invented puddle, a pond she and her husband had dug into the marshland of their New Hampshire property in 1963. She loved that pond and swam in it as much as she could. She watched it freeze in winter, the ice crackling like target practice. In spring, she watched the tadpoles quake from the jello and come into being. The otter, she observed, is a spectacular swimmer. She likened the cupping and pull of handholds on water to the rhythm of a song, the soundtrack of a swim. It was an idea she kept returning to again and again, in different works over the decades. Cumin's most famous and iconic poem, Morning Swim, was also her favorite. Fish twitched beneath me. Quick and tame in their green zone, they sang my name. And in the rhythm of the swim, I hummed a 2-4 time slow hymn. Here, she writes of the musicality of that swim. The fish have a beat, and so does she as she kicks her feet. The beauty comes from the rightness of timing, everything in sync, from breath to bubbles. In this falling into synchronicity between the body and the environment, the dividing line between the two ceases to exist. Swimming is something that requires us to make our bodies a part of another body unlike ours, that of water. She notes that as she enters the water enters her. The conjoining is complete. Reading Cumin helps me realize how much swimming is an unflinching giving over to an element. Her record of the pleasures amplifies my own awareness of what absorbs me when I swim. Something as simple as rounding a rocky promontory into a breath-stealing change in temperature. What does it feel like? something as simple as looking at brook trout, the Mr. followed by the Mrs. Where are they going? Something as simple as diving in from rocks and aiming to come up into the fizz of lime green light. Will I emerge transformed? In these small moments of observation, there is frozen time. In the period that I'm writing this, I visit a woodsy old resort area in Sonoma County with two friends and go swimming in the Russian River. It's late spring and dry in Northern California, the midday sun hot, the mosquitoes already whining, but the breeze ruffles the tree canopy and hints at the cool evening to come. Entry into that slash of green water is brisk but not unwelcome, more like a friendly pat on the bottom, a little wake-up, than a rude punch to the face. I swim around the pebbled bend and turn upstream. Suddenly, it's as if I'm swimming on a treadmill, one of those endless pools with the constant current that holds you in place. I notice the leaves zipping by even as I swim, carried past me by the rushing water. I keep stroking, looking down, to see little twigs flying by. If I stop swimming, the incremental forward progress instantly becomes backward progress, and the upstream bend in the river recedes with shocking speed. I experiment with the hydroeconomy of my movements, swimming to hold position, pausing to drift back downstream. Swim to hold, pause to drift. Finally, I stop swimming altogether, holding my arms in front of me as I soar above the rippled river bottom. A fish flicks its tail into the depths, and then I turn onto my back to watch the sky rip by. I am alone, but I don't feel lonely. Out here in the river, to swim is to be a part of things. 16. The liquid state. What do we think about when we're swimming? Unlike land-based exercise, swimming requires submersion and that characteristic isolation. But isolation in this context is a rare blessing. In the always connected modern age, the medium represents a means of disappearing. Each pool is, in fact, a potential portal. Sometimes swimming is a wormhole through which to escape the grinding machinery of everyday life. I get in a lake and swim away as far as I can. When I get far enough away, literally and figuratively, I know it, because I find I want to go back. It's an exercise in thresholds. How much I can take, how much distance I need, how far I can get from shore before I feel afraid. At what point I desire to return to land. I brew and brood over things that seem to be of consequence, but by the end of the swim, the water has washed much of that away. I come out with my mood and mental clarity improved by a minimum of 48%. Cold, metallic sky on a fall morning. Cool rain dimpling the surface of the pool. I cruise along in backstroke, feeling the here and nowness of the warm water. A crow flies across my field of vision. How many birds poop in the pool each day? This is not the most profound thought I've ever had while swimming, but it's a favorite, nonetheless. Birds fly overhead all the time. They poop quite frequently. We see the evidence of this on our driveways, on our cars, in the school parking lot. What about when they let fly over a body of water? What about over my body and water? When and how often does this happen? I follow the skip and jump of my mind to the edge of the pool and into the gutter, where I hope the poop ends up. I find that I'm delighted to be ruminating on bird shit. The pleasure of this whole processional of thought stems from its curious novelty, the unexpected left turns, the thinking for thinking's sake. Other days, I sing songs or make to-do lists or fantasize about what I'm going to eat for breakfast. Suffice it to say that it's not just profound thought that can clear one's mind. Most days, if I'm not in the ocean for a surf at first light, I get into the neighborhood pool by 8:30 a.m. Even when there's frost on the ground, the water is warm. Unless you're the lifeguard, blowing the whistle when you want me to get out, I don't know you exist. For 60 blessed minutes and 3,200 yards, I'm my only audience. In a pool, there's nothing much to look at once the goggles fog over. I have spit and sprayed all manner of anti-fog fixes into them, and none has kept the mist from creeping up on my vision like cataracts. But I'm okay with that. Sound? The sloshing of water pretty much cancels out everything else. Taste and smell are largely of the chlorine and salt variety, though at my old pool, I used to smell burgers cooking from the cafe downstairs. Nowadays, I get whiffs of eggs and hash browns from the high school cafeteria next door. Despite all the tech advances of the last few years, you won't see many swimmers wearing earphones or bone conduction music devices. They just don't work that well. Submersion creates internal quiet, too. Sometimes swimming to blankness is the goal. We enter the meditative state induced by counting laps and observe the subtle play of light as the sun moves across the lanes. We slip from thought to thought, and then there's a momentary nothingness. In that brief interlude, we are entirely liberated from the weight of thinking. When he was a child, Michael Phelps was diagnosed with ADHD. Back then, the pool was his safe haven, in part, he says, because being in the pool slowed down my mind. More recently, in retirement, away from the stress of competition, he has talked about the pool as a place of sanctuary and renewed mental health. In John Cheever's 1964 short story, The Swimmer, Nettie Merrill swims home through the backyard pools of his suburban neighbors. To get there, he must navigate the parties and social merriment surrounding every body of water. At one stop, Nettie stood by the bar for a moment, anxious not to get stuck in any conversation that would delay his voyage. When he seemed about to be surrounded, he dove in and swam. Water, then, is a bubble in which all social pressure is easily eluded. Coach Jay tells me that a long swim leaves his mind calm, collected, and organized in a way that other sports don't. It's hard to leave the pool angry about something, he says. It doesn't lend itself to that. As the world, with its escalating rings and pings, gets ever more hysterical, suspending yourself in water becomes ever more appealing. Theories and stories would construct themselves in my mind as I swam to and fro or round and round Lake Jeff, Oliver Sacks wrote in Water Babies, one of my favorite essays of all time. 500 lengths in a pool were never boring or monotonous. Instead, Sacks said, swimming gave me a sort of joy, a sense of well-being so extreme that it became at times a sort of ecstasy. The body is engaged in full physical movement, but the mind itself floats, untethered. Beyond this, he added, there is all the symbolism of swimming. Its imaginative resonances, its mythic potentials. Echoes of Byron. One recent weekday morning at the pool, I watch an 8-year-old boy and his teenage sister swim their laps beside me. The boy shivers on land, lips blue and knees knocking, but when he hits the water, he is confident, focused, as fluent in the medium as a seal. For a little while, there is just a boy in his buoyancy. This is not to say that swimmers find it easy to be Zen masters. Bill Clinton once told PBS that he and Hillary swim together every afternoon. If either dares to mention a political topic during the course of their swim, he said, we will stop the other one. I asked Dara Torres, who has amassed countless training hours for her 5 Olympics, what she thinks about when she's swimming. I'm always doing 5 things at once, she tells me by phone. At the time, she was driving a car. So when I get in the water, I think about all the things that I have to do. But sometimes I go into a state. I don't really think about anything. The important thing, she says, is that the time is yours. You can use it for anything. It depends where your head is at. It's a reflection of where you are. The reflection of where you are, in essence, a status update to you, and only you. And the experience is egalitarian. You don't have to be a great swimmer to appreciate the benefits of sensory solitude and the equilibrium the water can bring. Notable waters in literature, art, and movies where our imaginations have gone swimming. The depths of the Ionian Sea, into which an angry Poseidon plunged Odysseus, who was eventually guided by the goddess Athena to a safe landing on a riverbank on Scyria, supposedly today's Corfu. Homer, The Odyssey, 8th century BC. the Atlantic coast of Africa, where local water spirits blended with European iconography to produce Mami Wata, or Mother Water, a mermaid deity with a double tail who swam with the African diaspora to such places as Haiti, Brazil, and the Dominican Republic. Late 15th century. The Tiber River, in which Cassius and Caesar once had a swimming race, and Cassius rescued a tiring Caesar, later citing it as an example of his own superiority to Caesar. William Shakespeare, Julius Caesar, 1599. The Louisiana coast of the Gulf of Mexico, where Edna Pontellier teaches herself how to swim, and ultimately drowns herself, to free herself from the grim fetters of societal expectations. Kate Chopin, The Awakening, 1899. A tour of the Gulf Stream, off the coast of Cuba, a three-day journey experienced by the aging fisherman Santiago while being pulled by a giant marlin who won't stop swimming. Ernest Hemingway, The Old Man and the Sea, 1952. Across the Yangtze River, an actual swim by Mao Zedong that straddles fact and fiction when presented as communist propaganda in a poem supposedly written by the chairman himself. Mao Zedong, Swimming, 1956. A backyard swimming pool in California, signifying the open canvas that is an aimless young man's life, no thought of what's next until Mrs. Robinson shows up. Mike Nichols, The Graduate, 1967. A pool in the south of France, which sets the stage for the unraveling of the painter's relationship with his partner, even more meaningful when juxtaposed against that painter's iconic poolside scene of blissful gay domesticity. David Hockney, Portrait of an Artist, Pool with Two Figures, 1972. A beach in Miami as a storm rolls in, where a boy nicknamed Little floats in the arms of a drug dealer named Juan who is teaching him to swim, all of it making for a stirring, revelatory moment of metamorphosis. Barry Jenkins, Moonlight, 2016. People often tell me about their swimming habits. For example, how, when they visit or move to a new city, the first thing they do is account for all the pools and open water. It's a way to get to know a place. It's how they map out unfamiliar geographies and make them their own. When I was growing up, my father told me about Hainan Island, the Chinese Hawaii, perched on the South China Sea. To the Chinese, Hainan has always had a romantic frontier air about it. As the southernmost point in China, it is the only tropical island, and it served for centuries as a place of exile for poets and politicos. To my father, a Hong Kong-born painter who divorced my mother and left New York to go back and live in China, it was a dream of a place, a palm-fringed paradise that represented the ideal inspiration for him. There was a time in my early 30s when I hadn't seen my father in 3 years. One morning, I took a deep breath and called him up. My work would take me to Hainan that year. "Come swimming again," I said, my stomach full of butterflies. "Come meet me in the South China Sea." And he did. The island was in the midst of a development boom, but still we were able to walk on stretches of empty white beach, with spearmint waves lapping the shores, and take drives to the rural inner parts of the island. A Chinese acquaintance back home wrote out a traditional poem for me from memory, a long verse with many characters about Hainan's famously striking landscape. "Hainan is very beautiful," he'd said. "I've never been there, but I learned about it in school." I brought the poem with me, which my friend had written in Chinese, and asked my father to translate it for me when we were in Hainan. The island's legendary mist-clad cliffs and coastlines, straight out of the old calligraphy scrolls and paintings, came to life. I tried to forget that as a child, my father was a daily constant in my life. Once, when I was 12, he told me I was his best friend. It hurt to remember that. As an adult, I saw him only every year or two. The first time I insisted on visiting him in China, on my way back from that college semester abroad in Australia, I screamed and cried at him, not for leaving my mother, but for the way he did it. There was no swimming on that trip, but there was a pool's worth of tears. On Hainan Island, we came together in a truce. The trip was a pilgrimage for me, to a new, more forgiving place. I coaxed him into accompanying me on a swim. He, the former lifeguard, could not remember the last time he went swimming. His butterfly wasn't half bad. The air was humid, the water was warm, enveloping, a balm. He looked happy. As I floated on my back and stared at that cloud-streaked sky over the South China Sea, I felt that I was too. Franz Kafka observed that the truth is always an abyss. One must, as in a swimming pool, dare to dive from the quivering springboard of trivial everyday experience and sink into the depths, in order to later rise again, laughing and fighting for breath, to the now doubly illuminated surface of things. We dare to jump so we can see something new, and sometimes we do it to recover a sense of what we once had. 17. From one swimmer to another. Once upon a time, I fell in love with a family and a lake. In the ritual of swimming, the connection of one body to another, of one person to another, there is a flow of a different sort to be found. The first summer we were together as a couple, Matt took me to visit his grandparents at their cottage on the northern shores of Lake George, 5 hours north of New York City. Ted and Shirley met on a swimming raft on that lake in 1939 and got married after the war. Their safe harbor was the tiny hamlet of Silver Bay and the grand old YMCA resort that had been there since 1899. Matt and I were young ourselves on that visit, just out of college, and would not be married for another 8 years. But that liquid mercury lake, framed by evergreens and the picture postcard view from the screened-in back porch, would be a touchstone from the first. Everyone in the family had a particular way of crossing the lake. Grandpa Ted had a special affection for tooling around in fishing boats. He owned 3 in his life. The Ultimate Folly 1, 2, and 3. Each larger and more elaborate than the last. No one could remember him having ever actually caught a fish. Uncle Chris, all 6'5" of him, folded himself into a kayak before paddling across. Matt's mom, Robin, loved to float around in a rubber dinghy. She wasn't a frequent lake crosser, but she was a spirited shore dabbler. Her husband, Jan, a marine surveyor, traversed the waters on a windsurfer and later on a stand-up paddleboard. Uncle George, a National Outdoor Leadership School instructor and all-around outdoorsman, liked to sail. Matt's little brother, Jesse, had just earned a license to pilot the 13-foot Boston Whaler. One morning over breakfast, and his daily crossword puzzle, Grandpa Ted casually mentioned that he and his friends used to swim the mile from Silver Bay across the lake to Diver's Rock, for generations the spot where children have made a heart-stopping jump into the water. That was the thing to do back then, like swimming the English Channel, he said, his eyes sliding over to me before returning to the crossword, each completed square lettered in unwavering ink. If you said you'd swim across the lake that day, that was something. My ears perked up. I smiled back at him. This was something I knew how to do, and he knew it. I loved the idea of joining the generations of lake crossers before me in a way that was me. He was handing me a personal invitation. That afternoon, we pushed off from Silver Bay, Matt swimming and me beside him, paddling Grandma Shirley's old blue kayak so he wouldn't get run over by speedboats. We made our way out past the sailboats and motorboats bobbing in the harbor, past the raft at Bay Beach, where Ted and Shirley first set eyes on each other, past the tiny island of Scotch Bonnet, where Matt's parents were married, past a man in a boat who yelled at us through a megaphone, "Swimming in the lake is hazardous to your health," what with all the boats and jet skis racing about. 45 minutes later, we arrived at Diver's Rock, the stone-faced cliff where each member of Matt's family has made the jump. It was a veritable water tour of his family history at Lake George. After we performed the solemn ceremony of jumping off the ledge, it was my turn to swim back across the lake. I tried not to think of the speedboats and trusted my man on the blue kayak to keep me safe. The water was pancake flat and perfect. When I beached myself on the shores of Silver Bay, I felt initiated. I thought I finally understood something about what the place meant to Matt and to the company of lake crossers before us. 8 years later, we continued our Lake George swim, the day after our wedding, with 40 of our closest friends in the flotilla. Both sets of our maternal grandparents were there to witness it, and I suppose you could say that I swam from one family into another. We returned, year after year. Even after we moved across the country to San Francisco, we kept going back, sometimes in fall or winter, mostly in summer. There have been variations on the swim. One New Year's Day, our bare feet stinging in the snow, Matt and I held the first and only meeting of the Silver Bay Polar Bear Swim Club. Total members, 2. In the years since, Grandpa has gone, Jesse too. When we go back now, it's the fireflies and the stars that get me every time. Much of modern life is filtered out through the dense trees and mountains on the winding approach to the lake. Those winking lights bobbing along the ground and filling up the night sky with their impossible density send a signal. It's a reminder to slow up and be awake to the real connections we have while we have them. I started out thinking that the pleasures of swimming were all about immediacy, about being in the present, but I have found that the act of swimming can serve as ritual too. It's not just this family, and it's not just this lake. Bodies of water are shared spaces, and this is the mythology to go with it. What is Guthlaugsund, anyway, but remembrance? Why do people do it other than to feel a kinship with Guthlaugr and their fellow Icelanders? In pursuit of a great survival tale, what did I find? A swimmer-by-swimmer connection to the man himself. When you are tuned into the world and its forces, revelations follow. Swim with the current and you'll feel invincible. Swim against it and you suddenly become aware of the invisible forces against you. I want my own children to be unafraid, because they know that the current is there, because they know what to do when they face it. These are the swimming stories I carry with me. Pablo Neruda wrote 20 love poems and a song of despair, published when he was just 19. He uses aquatic imagery to depict the intoxicating gorgeousness of being in love, the loss of control when we're immersed in it. The 9th poem in the collection, Drunk with Pines, is my favorite, for its vivid conjuring of a pair of swimmers caught together in the outer waves, two passionate parallel bodies, one yielding to the other, like a fish infinitely fastened to my soul. What are these, if not stories of love? When it comes to swimming, we can understand flow to mean not just the expansive, timeless state of being that Csikszentmihalyi defined, but also the flood of thoughts that swimming enables, and the connection we have to each other and to the planet we inhabit. Flow. From Old English, flowen. From the same root, floer, Old Norse floa, to flood, and Dutch, floeien, to flow. The word holds other secrets, too. Latin plorare, to weep. Sanskrit plu, to swim, bathe. Old High German, fluen, to rinse. Greek floin, to swim, float. I follow the downstream movement of language, and it offers up a raft of connections. Flood, weep, swim, bathe, rinse, float. Trace this lineage and it reveals an unfettering and unburdening, whether physical, a release of the body to water, freed from its customary weight and gravity, or emotional, through a good cry, the cleansing release of tears. In the sea, a tidal flood of water traveling from thousands of miles away can absorb the small individual burst of a dam. Elation may be essential to the flow state, but so too is a slice of sorrow, embedded in the very history of the word itself. Even in grief, the breakup of my parents, a miscarriage, the death of a friend, I have marked time by water. I won't linger on these sorrows because I don't mean to say that swimming cured me of them. But I will say that swimming in all of its permutations, in a pool, in a lake, paddling a surfboard out to sea, has always helped me come out on the other side of a difficult time. The tides keep changing, twice a day. Water is in a forever state of flux. To swim is to witness metamorphosis in our environment, in ourselves. To swim is to accept all the myriad conditions of life. I think back to the beginning. We float in the womb. When we first learn to swim, we first learn to float. I watch the waves roll in and how they lift us all together. If I am floating here in San Francisco and you are floating across the Pacific in Tokyo, are we not floating together? Thousands of miles from where Tony Kundi lives in Tokyo, his parents have a house on the southwest coast of England, where they look out over the English Channel. Whenever he's swimming in a lake or river in Japan, practicing the strokes of Nihon Iho, he feels that he is connected to them. The pleasure of swimming for him is in large part the space it creates to think about where he is. However you draw the line, he tells me, water connects you. For the past several years, I have watched my two sons, Felix and Teddy, now 8 and 6, become swimmers. From the beginning, I expected fear, but I was eager and hopeful for the moment when it would give way to something else. It turned out that fear for them was fleeting, though it would register every now and then with a shift in reference point. Pool to ocean, say, or warm water to cold. What came in quick succession was curiosity and tentative exploration, giddiness at gliding independently from the wall, leaps into the pool, spontaneous underwater somersaults, joy. I remember floating in the glassy, ultramarine Pacific at Tunnels Beach, on the north shore of Kauai, while pregnant with Felix, my sun-warmed belly poking above the waves as I took in the rippling red and green cliffs of the Nepali coast. 6 years later, Matt and I began a sabbatical summer, a 3-month break from the daily grind, back on the island, in the little north shore town of Haena. I wanted Felix to feel that buoying for himself, outside of me, fully aware of the pulse of water on his lanky young body. I wanted a kind of time travel, to hold him simultaneously in this place as a baby and a boy. Little by little, Felix got comfortable in the gently rolling surf. He bobbed. He practiced his freestyle and his backstroke. He looked for brilliant pink and blue parrotfish. Alongside the locals, he learned to body surf to the sand. Felix learned to love the feeling that the water there was in some way alive and different from the stillness of a pool. One day, he befriended a stout, sun-bronzed, middle-aged body surfer named Dave, who shouted encouragement and expertly propelled himself toward shore with elan and grace. That evening, my son drew a picture of himself body surfing in the waves with his new friend, Dave. Years later, Felix talks about him still. Every morning at Tunnels, I swam a mile or more, zigzagging between reefs and following the locals to what they could show me. Once I tailed 2 spear fishermen, clad in their dusky green camouflage wetsuits, and spotted 4 large sea turtles resting at the bottom of the ocean. They were being feasted on by tiny fish known as cleaner wrasse. In a marvel of symbiosis, the wrasse detailed the turtles' hard shells by hoovering up parasites and dead skin. An efficient 45 minutes later, the young fishermen emerged from the sea with the day's catch in hand. Huge mahi-mahi, 2 each. On other days, I swam alongside ropey-armed surfers as far as I could before they paddled beyond the outer reef, where the wind whipped white caps across the sea. I treaded water and watched safely from within the reef as they made elegant, sinuous turns across the face of each wave as it broke. We became friendly with the young family living nearby, whom we saw often during these mornings. The toddler daughter liked to investigate our snacks and toys and played with Teddy. The father, nut brown from the sun, sat by the sea gathering tiny, intricately patterned shells the size of baby teeth that he said were once collected only by the holiest of Hawaiian priests. One morning, as I swam in the coral-punctuated shallows, two men called my attention to a 4-foot shark resting on its side in the waist-deep water. It was a juvenile, they said. It had probably died while trying to find its way back to deeper water through the maze of vividly colored nearshore corals, some boulder size, others cactus-like, still others resembling giant brains with lobes. Later, a lifeguard in sunglasses and red swim trunks roared up in a dune buggy and dragged the shark up onto the beach. Bystanders came around to stare at its smooth gray hide, bloodied nose, and clouded over eyes. The episode didn't stop any of us from swimming, but it was yet another sobering reminder, welcome or not, of the ocean's ever-present dangers: sharks, riptides, razor-sharp reefs. As an adult, I have come to appreciate water, an ocean, a lake, a pool, as a mode of inner as well as outer transport. In the middle of Honolulu, one of my favorite swimming spots is Ala Moana Beach, along the downtown waterfront. In the middle of the city, steps from high-rise towers, the glassy, reef-protected ocean at Ala Moana serves as the de facto communal pool. To swim there is to experience the place at water level. Turn your head, Makai, toward the ocean to breathe, and there are surfers paddling out to the break. Turn your head, Mauka, toward the mountains, and there are Japanese brides and grooms having pictures taken on their wedding day. From this perspective, everything feels strangely possible. Why do I swim? Many pages ago, I said that I was a character in this book too. But maybe it's the opposite. Swimming has always played a central role in my life, constant but mercurial, a shapeshifter. I have written about survival, well-being, community, competition, and flow as separate streams of reasoning. But in truth, they all run together. A swim can take different forms, different moods, and different functions, depending on the time of day, the time of year, the time of life. It can cast light, or filter it, or block it altogether. It can be energizing or enervating. It can pull me to a place of comfort or push me to a place of fear. It can remind me through ritual or help me forget through flow. Swimming helps me to slow down and to speed up. I have practiced enough to know how to be calm and how to generate controlled fury. I can forget myself in a bathtub-warm lake or in a steam-wisped Icelandic lagoon. Be so exquisitely present that every glint and glimmer is seared into my brain forever. Here is the writer Rebecca Solnit on the color blue. It is bewitchingly the color of their scene from here, the color of where you are not. There is a seductiveness to water. From afar, it gleams and glistens, a shiny liquid jewel. It is inviting. It swirls, fans, and coalesces, embracing you. It holds you and yet cannot be held by you. When we immerse ourselves, something is awakened. It is as if eyesight has been turned on, or hearing. It is a vital new sense discovered. When I was a teenage lifeguard, I once saved a little girl from drowning. Those eyes underwater, big as dinner plates. As I towed her to the side of the diving tank, the tensed muscles of her body made her feel remarkably heavy for such a small, skinny child. She got out of the pool and promptly burst into tears. When her brothers and sisters ran over, they exclaimed that she didn't know how to swim. "Why did you jump in if you don't know how to swim?" I asked her, gently. Her only answer was more tears. As the girl's siblings bundled her away in a towel and comforted her, an old awareness surfaced in me. Recalling myself on that long-ago day at Jones Beach. Drowning is quiet and quick. Someone might notice, or no one might. It strikes me now that we responders are moved to ask, why? Why jump in if you can't swim? Why endanger yourself so illogically? The little girl couldn't explain it, just as I couldn't put into words what I felt when I was her age, tumbling in the surf. But I know the answer now. Blue, the color of where you are not. Wherever it is I might be in my head, the winking where you are notness of water issues an invitation to go elsewhere. it's an escape from Earth's terra firma, with regularly scheduled departures. I am reminded of it every time I slip into an unfamiliar body of water, eager to see the way it behaves once I enter its liquid mass. Will it absorb me easily, imperturbably, or will it chop, splash, resist with every stroke? The soft, muted salt of a pool is different from the gritty mineral flavor of the sea. So is the mint candy look of the Caribbean versus the cobalt vastness of the Aegean. I want to try all the flavors. I think my thirst for them is what Neruda called my solid marine madness. This color-saturated expansion of life goes beyond the natural world to encompass the man-made. On a flight to Palm Springs, I see the geometry of pool-centric living clearly laid out below in the repeating grid of turquoise rectangles, ovals, and odd little squiggles. Pools can be anywhere and are especially necessary in a landlocked locale. Enter and you may go anywhere in your thoughts. Enter in the specific geography of Southern California, for example, and you gain insight into the American optimism of the post-World War II era. This is where Hollywood once went to get away, where people found escape by diving in. The very idea of these sapphire pools as escape infiltrated the iconography of American film and literature. Or take a dip in a hot pool in Iceland in the dead of winter, and you'll see through a crack the delicious warmth reviving you to the nocturnal pleasures of the once forbidding dark. We have put pools in places where they are necessary for surviving the pressures of modern life. Pools are a symbol. It is possible to emerge from the water reinvented, a new version of yourself. In a typical pool, the distance between the diving board and the ladder is 20 feet, maybe. But so much more separates the two. In that space, we might catch a glimpse of what we desire. I remember the summer Felix jumped off a diving board for the first time. As he stood there, on the plank gathering courage, I saw an ocean of possibility open up in the space that separated his tiny, dripping body from the water below. He sprang toward the ladder at the side of the diving tank, and I saw myself reflected in the water, in him, as he took flight, arms outstretched, suspended there for one glorious moment. What did I wish for him? An elemental understanding of water, of how it can be a portal to somewhere else. He hit the water with a muted, backlit splash. When he bobbed up to the surface, he paused, just for a heartbeat. Then he began to swim. Epilogue. In early May 2018, Kim Chambers was diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome, a rare neurological disorder in which the body's immune system attacks the nerves, causing numbness and paralysis that can quickly spread across the entire body. The paralysis started one morning in Kim's left foot, but it crept up to her legs and arms so rapidly that when she finally consented to going to the emergency room, she was struggling for breath. Later, the doctors told Kim that she had been 90 minutes away from respiratory paralysis. Had she not gone to the hospital when she did, she would have suffocated. When she left the intensive care ward, she was paralyzed from the waist down and had trouble speaking. The cause of Guillain-Barré is unknown, and there is no cure. About 80% of adults recovering from the illness can walk independently 6 months after diagnosis, and about 60% fully recover motor strength in a year. 5 weeks after Kim entered the hospital, she was back in San Francisco Bay on the occasion of her 41st birthday. A 5-minute immersion that required one wheelchair, a 3-hour recovery nap, and an endless circle of friends. The body, she says, follows the mind. For the second time in her life, she has thrown herself into full-time physical therapy to relearn how to walk again. Fatigue, lingering paralysis, and nerve pain, though, are reminders to take a moment to look up every now and again. With my first medical misadventure, I became a swimmer, she tells me. It was the best thing that happened to me. So with this latest one, I just know there's something else amazing down the line, and I'm humbled to find out what it is. She says that the moment where you begin, when you commit to yourself, is the scariest moment. jumping into the pool for the first time after almost losing a leg, or jumping off a boat at the Farallon Islands on a dense, ink-black night, unsure if the landing zone is right in the mouth of a great white shark. But Kim is jumping into this new life with both eyes open. And, as with the first time around, she has found the water to be a willing midwife to her rebirth. This recording of Why We Swim was presented by Dreamscape Media, LLC. Text copyright 2020 by Bonnie Choi. Sound recording copyright 2020, Dreamscape Media, LLC. This recording was produced by arrangement with Workman Publishing Co., Inc. Thank you for listening. Please check dreamscapeab.com for Dreamscape's latest releases.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.